Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday and time for the Week in Review. And let's start with racial tensions at Boston Latin School. The Boston Public School District's Office of Equity concluded its investigation of racist incidents at Boston Latin, but Michael Curry, president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, says it didn't go far enough.
I'll call that the smoke. But what the smoke is leading us to is the fire. There are other stories starting to come out, and I think that is the point of an investigation, is to get to those stories. And I believe BPS did not follow the leads to these other stories.
And that's one of the reasons why the Boston branch of the NAACP is calling for a federal investigation into Boston Latin. Curry has also called for Headmaster Lynn Mooney Tata to resign. Others, however, say such demands are premature. Here's Superintendent Tommy Chang.
I would say these sort of conversations are conversations about issues that have existed for decades, if not for hundreds of years. This is the oldest school in the country. So to put everything on this headmaster, I don't think is fair.
So quite a bit to discuss. And joining us today to do so is Jabari Asim, professor of creative writing at Emerson College and executive editor of The Crisis, the journal of the National NAACP. Jabari, great to have you back.
Thank you.
Also with us is Boston Globe op-ed columnist Dante Ramos. He's joining us today from the offices of the Globe. Dante, great to have you as well.
Great to be here.
All right. So first of all, Jabari, I just want to make one point of clarification. You're editor of The Crisis, which is the journal of the National NAACP, but does it have any links to the Boston branch of the NAACP?
No, I work out of the national office. I have met members and leaders of the Boston branch, but I don't speak with them regularly and haven't spoken with them on this issue.
Okay. So is it fair to say that nothing you say is representative of the Boston branch of the NAACP?
That's very fair to say.
Okay. So
yes.
Journalistically, I just wanted to cover that ground there. So let me just start with you. What do you make of the fact that Michael Curry and others have called for a federal investigation into what's been happening at Boston Latin?
Well, I think we have a mixed record where federal investigations are concerned, particularly around civil rights issues. But typically, civil rights leadership doesn't move to the federal level until they've concluded that they're not going to be able to get a resolution that satisfies them through the channels through which they've been working. So it suggests to me that they feel that it's time to take it to another level.
Mm. Well, Dante, yesterday we spoke with Michael Curry about this, and he basically said they've got what they believe are evidence of other incidents that hadn't been investigated by the Office of Equity, of course, they weren't entirely satisfied with the results of Boston Public Schools on investigation. So, I mean, do you think that asking the DOJ to get involved is warranted?
In a way, I was surprised that they are making the request of the DOJ. There's an office within the Department of Education, the Office of Civil Rights, which does a lot of civil rights type, obviously given the name, investigations in these sort of cases. So I was surprised by the venue that they're actually taking the request to. More broadly, I was a little surprised, I guess, by the strength or the heatedness of Michael Curry's rhetoric on this. It seems as though he has certainly gone to war, so to speak, with the findings of the school department.
Mm. And I mean, part of that war is actually also over whether or not Boston Latin School headmaster Lynn Mooney Tata should keep her job. And there are lots of differing opinions on this. So let's listen to Patricia Bonner Duval. She's a concerned parent and resident. After a meeting on Monday night that happened with Superintendent Tommy Chang.
When incidents of this magnitude happen in the city, the people who are in charge of institutions like this should be held accountable. Should she keep her job? No! If she was in the corporate community, she would have been long gone.
On the other hand, Catherine Campbell, a former member of the school's parent council, said this.
I would hope that the path that has been identified by Superintendent Chang with a carefully laid out plan to address these obviously difficult issues that are faced by, the students at BLS should be allowed to move forward.
Jabari, I mean, what do you make of that? Obviously, leadership should be held accountable in some way. Headmaster Lynn Mooney Tata wrote a letter of apology, but that doesn't seem to satisfy some parents and even some of the students at Boston Latin.
Well, it raises questions for me. I mean, typically these civil rights organizations, and I understand it's not just NAACP, but it's an umbrella group, legal action is almost always preceded by investigation, which suggests to me that, and in many of these instances, what the public knows is only a fraction of what's actually going on. So it makes me curious about other things that they may, other information they have that may have shaped them to take this opinion.
Yeah. And Dante Ramos, on the other hand, I mean, at the beginning of this conversation, we played some tape from Superintendent Chang, who said it's unfair to heap sort of the whole, not just what's happening at Boston Latin, but the conversation has broadened to race in Boston schools overall. And he said it's unfair to heap all of that on her.
I would agree, and I think to some extent a couple of different things are being conflated. The incidents that have been investigated most recently have involved, for example, some threats made to a student and some questions over whether the school adequately disciplined that the people involved. Also, investigations of certain tweets that students made. You know, it seems to me in those cases, I don't see a prima facie case that the school has radically mishandled these immediate matters in a way that would require the headmaster's resignation. There do seem to be deeper tensions, longer standing tensions at Boston Latin School. You know, there for many years, there have been complaints that this is a very selective school in a minority school system. Mm-hmm. And yet there are a lot of, there are a lot of kind of upper class white parents who their children don't participate in the school system at the lower grades. And then all of a sudden are at Boston Latin High School. And there's a sense that Boston Latin is not reflective of the school system as a whole. I mean, these seem to me to be the deeper tensions that the superintendent is referring to, and they really are legitimate issues.
Jabari, did you want to say something about that?
One of the things that I find remarkable is that both the mayor and the superintendent even went there in terms of talking about the past, because looking at officials in similar positions in other cities, there's seldom an inclination to even expand the conversation in that way or to say, let's focus on this particular moment. What do the historical inequities have to do with what we're doing right now, when in fact they completely circumscribe what's going on right now? So I would actually give them some credit in that regard for even bringing it up. I found it somewhat unusual.
So I have to say, the historical context of Boston education and race is one that we haven't yet, outgrown, if I can say that, or come to terms with. And it's really coming to bear in this conversation. Because one part that we haven't discussed yet is that there were dueling letters over the past several days between the parent council at Boston Latin School, who said they're behind the headmaster and they think efforts to get her to resign are quote unquote a witch hunt, and then Michael Curry from the Boston branch of the NAACP responded with an equally passionate letter saying that they had pointed out that they believe there are certain aspects of Boston Latin that reminded him of South Africa, and we have a little bit of tape here of that.
We responded to that letter, and it is South African-like. It is apartheid-like.
So, Jabari, here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing which everybody does want is, they want not just Boston Latin, but Boston as a city to move forward in a productive way on this, to come to terms with race, but also move forward together. And I'm just wondering, isn't that made that much more difficult when people on both sides are using language like witch hunt and apartheid?
Yeah, at the same time, I'm a writer, so I'm looking at it this way. That's figurative language, and figurative language does work very effectively in bringing much needed attention to the issue. So I think both sides felt we have to raise the temperature of this discourse in order to expand it in order to have other people feel, hey, wait, that's crazy. Or, yep, that's exactly what I was thinking, and they've articulated it, right? So I think that...
But doesn't it make it that much harder for the person across the table? I mean, I'm looking at both sides of the table to say, we want to talk.
Well, part of it is I'm just reacting. Yeah. You just called me a name. I'm going to call you a name back. But I think sometimes there's a larger strategy. I mean, to draw an analogy between apartheid South Africa, in which this privileged group got to take, extraordinary advantage of the privileges and things that the school system and other parts of the infrastructure had to offer, I mean, it immediately gets my attention, even if I'm apathetic up to that point, or even if I'm not inclined to agree. I'm like, whoa, this is an entirely different conversation. Maybe I should pay attention.
Dante, what are your thoughts about that?
It seems to me that, certainly the comparison to apartheid South Africa would seem to overstate the case. I don't want to diminish the objection that Mr. Curry has raised. It does seem to raise the temperature quite a lot. I would hope that both sides, now having gotten each other's attention, would be able to take a deep breath and have a substantive discussion about the deeper issues that are at stake here.
Mm. And my last thought on this before I move forward is, quite frankly, the people I've been most impressed with in this whole debate as it's been moving forward are the original two students who raised this issue into our public consciousness here in Boston. Because they have been acting with continued maturity and grace, Kylie Webster Cazot and Maggie as well. So my hat's off to them for getting this conversation started and for being young leaders as well. But let's move on now to another big story this week, and that has to do, of course, with a casino in eastern Massachusetts, the Wynn Casino, which Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, eventually last month he reached an agreement with Steve Wynn on the construction of the planned Everett Resort. Everything seemed to be moving fine. We were supposed to break ground on that this spring. And then this week, Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone appealed an environmental permit awarded to Wynn. And then all of a sudden, Wynn said everything is on hold. Now, we spoke to Everett Mayor Carlo Di Maria on Wednesday, and he had this to say.
The reaction to most people and to myself especially is just kind of wondering why. They have the right to appeal our Chapter 91 license, but his grounds to me is kind of frivolous. When he's on the other side, and then speaking of Mayor Curtatone and Somerville, and he's building Assembly Row, we're just wondering why he wants to build in Somerville, but he doesn't want us building in Everett.
Well, on the other hand, Mayor Curtatone told WBUR on Wednesday that he and the folks of Somerville have some significant concerns about the waterfront, about traffic, about other things. Here's what he said.
I can introduce you to many families who are suffering the health consequences of living near and around a highway that's already congested and spewing pollution to the air, and this project will make their lives worse. What do we say to them?
Dante Ramos, what do you make of this? Everything seemed to be ready for groundbreaking at Wynn, and now it could be, 6 months to a year.
I'm not terribly surprised to see this process dragging out further. Massachusetts is famous for being a place where there are a lot of different avenues for people to, appeal permitting decisions that they disagree with. The casinos, I would argue, are even a special case too. This is an issue that has divided the state for a very long time. It does not surprise me to see Curtatone, who's been a sincere and adamant opponent of casinos all along, to try to exhaust his avenues of redress for a project he fundamentally dislikes.
Yeah, but what about, Assembly? As the folks in Everett are pointing out, Assembly Row is just right on the other side, right? Even Shirley Leung in the Globe said, is it okay for Somerville to have Assembly Row on the Mystic River that draws close to 24,000 cars on weekdays? But apparently that's not okay for the folks in Everett and their casino. Jabari, jump in here.
Yeah, that seems like a legitimate question. It seems like the force is not with Curtatone on this. Once you have the corporate behemoth of Wynn, through a combination of charm offensives, money, et cetera, sort of knocking down these hurdles of opposition systematically, and you combine that with the municipal behemoth that is Boston, you might think, it might be time to tuck and cover or to, some defensive posture that I would articulate. And so it's a little surprising to me, considering all that's at stake. He's up against the ropes, and that he's still swinging is puzzling.
Yeah,
it's puzzling.
Well, in fact, Dante, there was a Globe story this week that reported that in a private meeting with a Wynn advisor, Mayor Curtatone, quote, said he would lose all of his leverage if he didn't file this appeal of the environmental permit. To piggyback off what Jabari was saying, is that what this is all about?
Well, remember, the all of this discussion grows out of the state casino law. And one of the fundamental conflicts that was built into it is that it allows a lot of protection for the host communities, a community such as Everett, that will be the site of a community, and they cut a deal essentially with a casino operator and try to extract the greatest benefits for their community. There really aren't very strong protections for communities that are just outside the location of the casino and yet may still bear a lot of the brunt of the project. you know, I think it's something that is a fault within the design of the casino law. The casinos are meant to be projects that draw from, you know, from far away and have an economic impact far beyond their individual host communities. But the law, for pragmatic reasons, in the hopes of actually getting casinos here in the first place, did not really protect the interests of the surrounding communities in a way that somebody like Curtatone would want.
Does it not amaze you that this many years later, we're still finding faults with the original casino law? I mean, it seems like every turn that we've made in this long journey, there's a fault that we're discovering. But go ahead, Dante.
No, I would just say, you know, I guess whether this is a good thing or a bad thing depends upon your view of casinos. And I think there probably are other non-casino permitting disputes that have gone on for longer than this. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I think we can argue about.
Okay. We'll argue about it next week, because I'm sure we'll be eventually talking about it next week, too. But there's one more story that I want.
And a year from now, probably.
Yes. There's one more story that I did want to touch on before we got to our hubbubs. And that is the fact that an investigative story made headlines this week. It's from the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. And they were talking about the Boston Police Department's use of so-called stingrays. And these are devices that are used to track cell phones. They basically mimic cell phone towers so that cell phones in the surrounding area will ping off of the stingray and police can gather information that way. There's a lot of questions about how long and what the purpose is that the police department is using it for, whether or not a warrant is required. Boston Police Department isn't necessarily talking to the reporters on this story from the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, but really interesting eye-opener here. And Jabari, I just wanted to get your thoughts on the BPD's use of this technology.
Well, I'm automatically suspicious of law enforcement, both local police and FBI, just as a matter of course. And I think that the opportunity for abuse is astronomical. I mean, it's already happening in Baltimore, where supposedly they were using these devices for serious crimes, but it turns out they were using them for all sorts of crimes to track suspected criminals. So I'm deeply troubled by it. At the same time, I see it as part of, you know, a larger conversation in which we have to say, you know, I'm one of those people who fears we may have conceded the very idea of privacy anyway, right? So if we eliminated these trackers, you know, I've got a cell phone on my hip, I've got an iPad in my backpack, and I've got an Apple Watch on my wrist. There's so many different ways in which I am voluntarily subscribing to this idea that you can track me regardless of what I'm doing. So I think this, you know, it's these opposing poles. I want to be free. I want my civil liberties protected. But to a certain extent, as a consumer, I'm already participating in it.
Right.
But I don't trust law enforcement, particularly in this regard. And I think safeguards have to be in place, as some states are already doing.
I think one of the issues here is, as the reporters pointed out, there's so much we don't know about how the Boston police are using the technology. And they're not saying. On the other hand, earlier this week, Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans, you know, did say that in response to the reporting, Dante, that, you know, he says BPD is only using it for, you know, very serious investigations. The standard of evidence for, say, homicides is really high, and that this is an important tool in order to gain the kind of evidence they need for a homicide investigation. And he said, you know, there's no abuse going on here of the technology. Your thoughts?
I think we are in that situation reliant upon the upon the police commissioner's word. The department, and I think it's not unique in this way, has been very coy about saying exactly what the technology does and how they're using it. And it's almost as though the technology is new enough and there's not enough information about it for us to even, you know, even have a sort of informed superstition or suspicion about it. And I think that's actually problematic. I don't think that the average citizen necessarily, as suspicious of law enforcement as someone at the ACLU might be. I do think that the average citizen wants to know what are the things that they're generally trying to do and how are they going about it and what are their policies for using it.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that we have that level of clarity here. I will say that there have been other law enforcement technologies in the past that have been new, and over time, as use has, as their use has seeped into law enforcement, that the courts have begun to reel that back in because they see how it's used in practice. And I would predict that over time this would happen with this technology also.
Yeah. Well, so finally, we have just enough time for kind of a lightning round of hubbubs. And Jabari, I'm going to call you.
I'm shrugging my shoulders.
You're going to make it easier to do this lightning round. You get a pass this week, okay? Next time we have you, you got to bring two.
I got to bring two.
Okay.
You got me.
So Jabari's going to take a pass on the hubbubs. Dante, do you have one?
Sure. Well, speaking of lightning, I guess, the MBTA has its share of malfunctions, even when passengers aren't carrying devices that might suddenly catch fire. But the hot toy/transportation device of this past holiday season is the hoverboard.
Yeah.
The only problem with them is that they cranked out so many of them, and there's so many fly-by-night manufacturers in China who are making them, that they're using these substandard battery packs, and they tend to sometimes catch on fire. Airlines have banned them. The MBTA did so this week also. I just think, you know, there are safety issues on the one hand, but it's also the case that as the team makes do with an ancient fleet of trains, this is a reminder that new types of vehicles have their own problems too.
Absolutely. So my hubbub is, I got to do a tip of my hat to Tim Logan at The Globe, because he was writing about the fact that in Nantucket, a dock there was sold for $4.75 million to, quote, an entity with ties to Eric Schmidt, executive chairman of Google's parent company, Alphabet. So we have one dock in Nantucket that now we know is worth $4.75 million, which is like obviously more money than any of us will ever be able to spend on.
Speak for yourself.
What?
No, I'm kidding. kidding.
On the other hand, though, in the same story, Tim Logan reports that back in 2002, another dock in Nantucket sold for about $2 million. And then that real estate in that period of time in Nantucket in the intervening 14 years or so did double in value. So
wow.
It's like it's on track. But on the other hand, you know, Google, a Google person, a.k.a. Eric Schmidt, might be pulling up to a Nantucket dock sometime soon. But my actual hubbub is two quick things. One is, for our listeners in Nantucket, send me a tweet. We're at Radio Boston. I want to know what you think about this, about Eric Schmidt. I mean, he's had property on Nantucket for a while, but about the $4.75 million price tag. And number two, Dante, who writes the headlines for the business section? Because this one was great. It's just Google Doc.
Ah, that's nice. That's very nice.
I will find out and pass that along.
All right, that's my hubbub for today. So Jabari Haseeb, executive editor of The Crisis, the publication of the NAACP, and also professor at Emerson College. Great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Dante Ramos, columnist for the op-ed page of the Boston Globe. Great to have you as well, Dante.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston.